You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Anyone can see signs of climate change. Ice is retreating. Each year is the new hottest record. The weather seems unstable. Plus, we have a constant stream of new science from all over the world confirming it. If the situation is becoming clearer, why are some scientists and top scientists still cautious? We'll find out with our next guest, a veteran organizer of scientific research. In 2007, Dr. David Carlson helped put together the International Polar Year. He has directed explorations into the ways oceans and the atmosphere interact. David led the Atmospheric Technology Branch of the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research, or NCAR, in the United States. Now Carlson is the director of the World Climate Research Program, or WCRP. From Geneva, David Carlson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Delighted to be with you.
You know, there's a rush now to break climate predictions down into regional models and even to quantify the role of climate change in particular events like superfires or storms. You have a different direction and maybe a worry about all this?
I understand that regional focus, and there's also a lot of very good, very challenging science around the attribution issue that you mentioned. How much does an individual event represent natural variability, or how much does it have a climate footprint or a climate push on it? But I think a larger group of scientists, and especially in the World Climate Research Program, try to look at the larger patterns behind that. What forced that particular event, or what set up that region for flood or drought? And in doing that, we rely on past experience quite a lot, because we can't run multiple planet experiments at one time. And I think there's a sense that those larger patterns are changing. And the question then is, why are they changing? And what does that do to our predictive skill?
Well, I want to get into that deeper for sure as we get going here. I want to bring up one issue first, though. One of Canada's brightest climate scientists is Dr. Andrew Weaver from the University of Victoria, except he quit to become the first Green Member of Parliament here in British Columbia. Now, on Radio EcoShock, Andrew Weaver questioned whether we need any more climate science. He says, we know more than enough to know that we're in deep trouble. It's time for action. David, what do you think? Do we need a lot more climate science?
That's a very interesting question. I think both answers are correct. We do know absolutely enough to change our energy systems, to change our carbon emissions, etc. But then the interesting question, and you can take this from a national point of view, is how much do we need to change? How can we expect those changes to influence our coastline or our agricultural systems? How long do we have to make those changes? What options? How severe? So yes, we know absolutely enough to get started, but I think we don't actually know enough to figure out our destination. So it's sort of like a trip. Yeah, let's get in, let's get going. Absolutely, I'm completely on that voyage. But where are we going to go? How are we going to get there? What's it going to look like when we get there? I think those are the questions of climate science.
Well, right. In an email, you told me that patterns are not what was expected. What did you mean?
Yeah, we watch the planet, and one of the things that we try to tease out are the various oscillations. Sometimes it's warm, sometimes it's cold, sometimes it's high pressure, sometimes it's low pressure. And some of these have predictability or patterns that we can detect. And one of these has been the ENSO, El Niño Southern Oscillation System, where warm water, winds, storminess move back and forth across the Pacific. And I think we had gotten, I would say, reasonable skill at predicting some of these. And that gives us confidence that we understand the system. If we say, okay, this year will be a warm event or a cold event in the ENSO warm-cold cycle, and therefore we'll get around the tropics, we'll get more rain here, or we'll get drought here, you know, that gives us a little bit of confidence. And that's important in our interactions with, as we said a moment ago, with regions, because then we can give them some predictions with confidence for agriculture, et cetera. But those patterns have sort of fallen apart. And if we look at ENSO, if you look in the textbooks, it's described as an every 5 to 7 year sort of warm event and then oscillation with a cold event in between, something like that. And 82, 83, 87, 88, 92, 93, 98. It was sort of regular. And then we had this gap from 98 until 2014. So we went, 15, 17 years without a big warm event. So the first thing we say is, well, why did that happen? Then if you watch what we did, we had a rather strong prediction of 2014 as a warm event. NOAA had it. The Bureau of Meteorology had it. It looked like really a good forecast, and then that warm event never showed up. After that, we went back again, and 2015 was actually a valid forecast in that case. We got a pretty good warm event, but its impact, for example, on the North American West Coast, the Eastern Pacific regions, like breaking the California drought or impacts on Peru, Chile, didn't happen the way we thought that. If you watch the predictions that people were saying, finally we'll break the California drought. But 2015 didn't do that. Now we're in 2016, or we just finished 2016, where we had sort of the cold event. And you would say that's not normally a wet year along the U.S. West Coast. But, of course, California just got dumped with a very healing winter snow accumulation. If you watch what's going on in Peru at the moment, it looks like a classic warm event. So these patterns that had some predictability, they were never perfect. And, you know, one warm event was never a perfect mirror of the previous one. But these patterns, which had some predictability, have sort of broken down, at least recently. And there's this new player on the block, which we call the Arctic. And science is quite divided right now about how much is the tropics impacting global and how much is the Arctic impacting global. And it's sort of like tropics, equatorial and tropics pushing on the mid-latitudes and Arctic polar pushing on the mid-latitudes from the polar end. And then the mid-latitudes where most of us live and where these weather patterns evolve seems to be influenced from both directions. And that requires us to sort of rethink our models and rethink our basic understanding.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, when I was first gathering climate news and reports in the 1990s, the rule was simple. The tropics determine the weather in the mid-latitudes where many of my listeners live. And now we've had Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers as our guest twice, and her observation is that the meltback of Arctic sea ice and lower snow cover on land has coincided, at least, with a jet stream that is slower and is bent, and that can shape significant weather events. What's your assessment on that discussion?
Yeah, she stimulated that, absolutely. And the initial reaction was, no, not possible, you know, can't happen. But there's a dozen studies, mostly from the observational record. If you look carefully, you can see exactly these patterns. Maybe they're in some regions, in some seasons, Northern Hemisphere winter, for example. But you can start to tease out these correlations from the observational records. The tricky bit at the moment, and science is trying to address this, is that the climate models, I was going to say for the most part, I would say many climate models don't reproduce that. Some climate models do. And if you force them in a certain way, sometimes you can get these patterns. So it's an interesting question for us as a climate research community. If one of our tools is telling us one thing, giving us this signal of an Arctic pushback on mid-latitude circulation, and we're not able to confirm that or reproduce that in our models, then I think it's inherent in us, and that's exactly the way the science is going, is to say, okay, what's going on here? And one of the approaches is to say, well, instead of doing this sort of as a sideline, meaning we take a model that's developed for global and we look to see if we see an Arctic, what if we focus the models on exactly this question and compared what Canadian model shows or what NCAR model shows or what the UK model shows, and start to make a focus on it. And I think that's exactly the stage that we're at, because we've got this inconsistency where you can see it in the observations if you're careful, and Jennifer and her group really set that off. But it's not possible in many of the models right now to actually pull the physics together and reproduce it. So we're sort of, one of our tools shows a good signal, the observations, and but the model's not yet. And I think that's exactly the situation we're in at the moment.
Well, all right, I'll throw a little gas on the model fire when I say that a recent guest has published a paper saying these biophysical climate models fail to include enough influence from humans and from this civilization. And that's Safa Modashari from the University of Maryland. He told us things like population and consumption can really change the environment that we're trying to model, but the biggest climate models have no dynamic inputs for those sorts of things or for the economy. Dave, is that fair? And can we include human drivers now in the Anthropocene?
Well, we have to distinguish between the physical climate models and then the impact and assessment models. We have a sort of a rule of thumb in climate modeling that we call no miracles, meaning we can't imagine some future carbon sink or a carbon removal process that will magically take carbon out. So we have to live with that. The climate models are in the stage where they evolve from a purely a physical model to a, what we call an Earth system model, which would fit what you called, Alex, a biogeochemical model, meaning that carbon actually, you know, plants actually grow, carbon actually goes into the ocean. You actually get an interactive carbon cycle rather than prescribing the carbon cycle. Do they have perfect resolution over urban areas or over tropical forests or any? They don't, because we can add all these features of the models, but we can't at the same time also get them to run 10 kilometer globally. So, yeah, we're limited by what our tools are. But my pushback on that comment is that the models are, on the physics, they're actually quite good. And when you are confronted with a challenge like this Arctic feedback, this Arctic influence problem, probably there's a lot to be learned by looking at those models. Why do some models and some under some forcings reproduce this effect? Why do others not? Is the weakness in how they treat the Arctic? Is the weakness in how they move heat and energy from the tropics towards the poles? So we can use the disparity among models as a sort of a diagnostic. And out of that, we'll both understand the system better, but also get better models.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm here with Dr. David Carlson, the director of the World Climate Research Program. I'm a bit nervous that the public is trying to nail down a fixed image of climate change these days. For example, we have several record hot years in a row, likely with Pacific Ocean temperatures as a driver. But what happens if we have three really cold years? Is that still possible?
It's absolutely possible. I don't think we can continue to set records every year. But the forcing function will be carbon. And so if we continue to put CO2 in, and we put a lot of CO2 in both 2015 and 2016, then we're going to get warm years. Is it always going to be a record warm month? We just did record warm February, NASA announced. No, it's not always going to be a record warm. We will not get, I think it would be unlikely for us to see a deep cooling. We're certainly not going to go for record cooling. But we're not going to set a record warm year or a record warm month and every year. But that's a little bit misleading, because generally what we're looking at when we look at those records are something relatively easy to measure, like surface air temperature, global surface air temperature. And what we really need to be looking at is where the energy is going, and that's in the interior ocean. And there, to the best ability of our observations, the heating in the interior ocean has been pretty much relentless. So we might get a cool year, or we might get a relatively cool year in the northern hemisphere, or we might get a relatively cool year over Europe, etc. But that's sort of like the small hair on the long tail of a big dog, and the big dog is the ocean, and that's where we really need to be looking.
Right. A week ago, friends in the East complained to me they were out in shirt sleeves in the afternoon and then snowed into a deep freeze later the same day. You might have been there then. I don't know. But it's not new in March. But, you know, after we get summer weather in December in North America and then hail in July, the public has begun to distrust the weather. Are we becoming too paranoid too soon, or is it the beginnings of climate change?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right question. If you look at our seasonal prediction for North America, we forecast this warm west, cold east pattern that we had in a recent year, for example. And that didn't really happen this year. And now we have to go back and figure out why. But that does not preclude cold, snowy events. I was just in Montreal, and they got a lot of snow. That does not preclude single cold, snowy events. And I don't think we can take any individual event and assign it as a harbinger of warmer or a harbinger of colder. We have to look at these big patterns. But exactly as you say, Alex, nothing's going to prevent us from getting a deep snow in Montreal or the U.S. Atlantic coast in springtime. And that's, if you look at the weather records, that's when that many of the big snows have happened in the past.
And you wrote to me, ecosystems prior to collapse very often show clear signs of unpredictability. What does that look like? Do you have an example handy?
Yeah, there's several examples. And this is interesting, this question of how does a system become predictable or become less predictable. It's definitely an issue in weather forecasting, and it's a sort of a complex system question. But some of the interesting examples have to do with ecosystems where you have a grazer, it's in balance with its food resource, maybe it's in balance with predators, maybe it's got diseases or parasites, so the system sort of, you get population oscillations, you get good years and then a couple low years and a good year. But when those ecosystems are relatively well in balance, the ecosystem itself functions in this sort of regular pattern, and they become reasonably predictable. If you know how much food resource there has been in a given ecosystem this year, you can predict what the grazers are going to do, and you can probably predict what the predators are going to do. And there's quite a lot of literature on this, especially on terrestrial ecosystems. But one of the things that happens, and unfortunately they have in that science several quite good examples, is when that ecosystem is stressed by changes in the resource base, for example, or changes in the predation pressure, they tend to go into large oscillations. So you get a very large population followed by a very low population collapse, and it might go through that a couple cycles, and then they get collapsed. It's reliable enough, or it's diagnostic enough, so they can watch these amplitudes of these population oscillations and say, whoa, that one's looking sort of wild. We might be close to collapse or something like that. And that's a lot of what in the biodiversity community you see as them building their predictive skill around this change from a regular predictable oscillation to a much wilder, unpredictable, and that lack of predictability then becomes an indicator of imminent collapse of that ecosystem. So it's not a perfect analogy, but it gets us on this issue of what features of a system, complex system, allow it to have predictability, higher predictability at one time and lower predictability at another. And what does that tell us about the external stresses on the system?
What is the World Climate Research Program, or the WCRP, that you direct?
It's mostly a small coordination program for the big world of climate science. Many of our most important activities have to do with the comparison of the climate models. So we do set the standards, we share the forcing data, we set up the infrastructure so that if you're at Beijing Center or if you're at a Canadian Climate Center or GFDL or UK, then you can share your climate data with other research around the world, and that sharing, that so-called CMIP, coupled model intercomparison project, then becomes the basis for the IPCC assessments and the UNFCCC policy negotiations. So we don't actually run any of the climate models. We don't actually fund any of those, but we sort of set up the sharing infrastructure, if you will, so that the people running those models can actually share their data and do the intercomparison. And we do a similar thing on the observation side. We share the data on carbon, we share the data on precipitation, et cetera. So we're sort of a coordination body that adds international cooperation and international value on top of these many very strong climate research programs.
Well, that sounds important to me. We do have to be able to talk to one another. And, you know, when I picture how climate research is working, I do see a lot of computing power, and I also see some very experienced scientific researchers that are kind of working together. I wonder if we're going to come to the point, though, where artificial intelligence will be churning away on masses of data much greater than you or I could ever handle, and come up with something and say, hey, by the way, humans, when the nitrogen cycle changes, so does the rainfall, or something that we hadn't expected.
Definitely in the size of data sets, both satellite data sets, ground-based in-situ data sets, ocean data sets, and the climate model outputs, we will use these data mining techniques. I don't think, at least in the short term, that it's going to be a sort of a random search around and artificial intelligence comes up with something, because these are careful, complicated human products. And it's not like something, you know, you can send a data mining a little robot or whatever they're called out to sort of graze around and find something. The climate modelers have been very careful about how these things are constructed. So I don't think there's a big surprise in there. I do think that because we're producing so much of these data, especially from satellites and from climate model outputs, that using these automated tools to visualize some of these things, and I'm not saying there wouldn't be discoveries or even surprises, but I don't think we're going to get a fundamental reset of our understanding of the climate system just because we put so much work into trying to get these models to work in the first place that I doubt that we're going to, you know, that machines are going to give us any kind of radical change in the way we understand climate.
All right. Now, who determines what the priority global research questions are?
Well, the researchers do this because they have to write their proposals. They have to get them funded. They have to compete for computing resources. And good, that it should actually be that kind of bottom-up energy ideas, explore the difficult, challenging problems. But every one of them, in climate at least, realizes that they can't do it alone individually, and they probably can't do it alone in their institution, so that the Canadian climate modelers need to understand what the Australians are seeing and how their model output compares with what the UK does, etc. So, yes, the energy and ideas grow bottom up, but in order to have a collective voice, in order to also do the kind of comparisons that allows us to both improve at the national level but also improve at the international level, then we need these coordinated activities.
Should we be optimistic about what we can still learn from continuing climate research? David Carlson, what do we hope the payoff could be?
Well, right now I think there's probably three questions. Let's assume that we get a good buy-in to a Paris Agreement. Let's assume that we start to get control over the carbon emissions. I think there's three questions. One is, where is the carbon going to go, which is not a question about how much are we going to emit or how much goes in the atmosphere, but it's really a question of how strong is the sink in the ocean and how strong is the sink on land. The second question is, how is the weather going to change with the climate, which touches exactly on several of the issues that we've talked about, Alex, which is, how do these extreme events in frequency or duration or timing change as the climate changes? And the third one is a little bit broader question, but I think it's challenging, which is, how will climate change the habitability of the planet and its regions. So it gets back to this regional question. And there we're thinking about things like sea level. That's a habitability question for all the coasts around the world. Again, back to these extremes, you know, long-term drought, long-term flood, long-term precipitation changes, large-scale changes in the circulation and the jet stream that we've talked about in this show. So it's a little more elaborate than just how will the climate change, but how will the climate change the habitability of our planet? And I think those three questions, where does the carbon go, how does the weather change with climate, and how does climate change the habitability? I think those are exactly the right questions that we need to know, whether countries are meeting their carbon targets or not. That's the kind of information that we need.
Well, as we wrap up here, is there anything else that you would like to talk about or tell our listeners?
I think this whole enterprise of climate modeling is one of the remarkable human activities. A climate model is a couple million lines of code. It's trying to represent in physics, in biogeochemistry, in a consistent numerical form, how the system works. How do leaves respond to sunlight? How does cloud processes produce precipitation? How does freshwater run off into the ocean? How does ocean mixing happen in the straits and over the topography of the bottom? It's a really audacious enterprise to say, oh yeah, I think we could actually put all that in a model. And I think that the fact that humans are trying to do it, that you know, roughly 20 modeling centers around the world are putting a lot of people on this problem. I think that's a really quite a remarkable resource, that their work tends to be disparaged from outside. It's easy to disparage it from outside, but the creativity and the innovation that's going into this task is one of the planet's human resources, and I think we're well set. I mean, that's exactly what humans should be doing. It's not automatic, you know, that it would succeed. So I think that's one of the really audacious task that climate research has put itself, and I really like the fact that the researchers have tried to do that.
These are the tools that Aristotle would have loved to have had.
It would be fun to try and explain to Aristotle and his concept of the phases, how that gets mapped out at 25 kilometer resolution in 47 layers in the atmosphere around the world. That would be a very interesting conversation.
It would be. We've been talking with Dr. David Carlson, the director of the World Climate Research Program in Geneva. You can find out more information with some links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Alex, it was fun. I'm glad to support what you're doing.
We're out of time again. Thank you for listening. Please join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
The economy comes first.
Workers have families to support.
If we don't sell it, someone else will. If we don't sell it, someone else will. If we don't sell it, someone else will. If we don't sell
it. That's all carbon crackhead talk.
Be realistic.
The transition will take years.
But they don't seem to be putting any real effort or money into the one really great emergency and threat that is coming. We have a cooked world. We are on our way towards a biologically dead planet.
In the blink of a lifetime, the whirlwind will sweep it all away.
Then our flight from reality and from the ideals of our founders will get this globe of ours torn to hot, flinders, spinning gases. To us citizens of Green Prairie, this promise of inferno poses a simple question. What new folly can you dream up with your coffee, your grapefruit, your first cigarette to keep yourself a while longer from facing the truth?